Thanks, Mark. I'm an alcoholic. You know, this box sits in the back of the room, and on it, it says a newcomer app. So we put some 3x5 cards and some pencils along with this box, and we'd like you to write down questions that you have about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Put your questions in this slot, and then every week we select the question to be answered live here. Using AA-approved literature and our own panel of experts, this week's question is, my question is, when you have 3 years sober and take one drink of a beer can, is it a slip? What the hell are you doing taking one sip of beer after 3 years of sobriety? Okay, here's my take on this, and it's not really my take because it's something somebody else said in a meeting. If you think you can take a sip of beer safely, you're probably right, and you can play Russian roulette safely too, for a while. Neither one is a real good idea. You want to take a sip of beer, it's just like holding that pistol to your head. Is there a round in that chamber or not? You don't know. If you're a real alcoholic like I am, you have no defense against the first drink. That's what it says in our book on page 24. Total abstinence. If you want to live the way we live in this program, that's the answer. So don't take one sip of beer after any length of sobriety. Don't play Russian roulette with your sobriety. That's my take on that. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 9/15 of 07. She is an active sponsor and the current secretary of the North Park Women's Group in Fresno. Her AA motto is, "Are you ready to go to any length?" And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Jen C.
I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. This is by far the best introduction I've ever had in AA yet. Thank you. Like you said, my sobriety date is 9/15/07. I really appreciate all the reading that you guys got going on here. I heard Working with Others, and I heard some Chapter 3, which is good. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I've never been on a stage before either, so I'm a little nervous now. There's a lot of yous out there. The way that it went for me is, well, the beginning of my story, I grew up in a family of non-alcoholics, pretty much. My mom and my dad didn't drink, they didn't do drugs, they didn't smoke cigarettes. Somehow they turned out two alcoholic drug addict children. But I found out, you know, later, well, as I grew up, that both my grandfathers were active, violent alcoholics, and I come from a traditional Mexican family where every event comes with beer kegs. So, you know, for like 3-year-old birthday, we'd have 3 beer kegs, and for weddings, we'd have 4 beer kegs, and for funerals, we'd have 5. And from the earliest that I can remember, I've been trying to change the way that I feel with something. Just because I just felt like, you know, I don't know, I think mostly it's just a case of I don't want to feel my feelings. I do 2 feelings well, that's happy and angry. Anything else in between, I pretty much will avoid at all costs. And so from a very early age, I can remember trying to change how I felt. And I did that, you know, from early, and my first, you know, with all those beer kegs around, I was able to, like, I was like the cousin that would sneak the beer into the punch from the beer keg and then run out and be like the cool one with the beer and the punch and then get busted, and like Aunt so-and-so would tell on me, and my dad would like come and be like, "What are you guys doing?" And then somebody would dump it out before we got to taste it and we wouldn't get caught. But from the from the first time that I had an unattended session with alcohol, that was when I was 14, and I was babysitting, and the kid went to sleep, and I found a Canadian whiskey and mixed it with strawberry soda, and it was horrible, but horrible tasting, but the exact effect that I was looking for. No cares, felt great, you know, wasn't worried about anything. Just this really, you know, like they say, like that sense of, that's what I've been looking for. I got through that night babysitting. I drank till I was satisfied with how I drank. You know, nobody was there to say, like, stop after two or you're going to get the spins, you know, and I felt fine. I got my money and I walked home. And Beverly Hills 90210 was on, for anybody old enough to remember that show. And I was sitting in front of the TV watching Beverly Hills 90210 with my little brother beside me and my mom and dad on the couch behind me. And the whole room started to spin. And so I crawled out of the room to the bathroom. And I was a weird teenager, so they didn't think anything of it until I fell in the bathroom and hit my head on the toilet. And then my dad broke down the door and my mom was crying like, we should take you to the hospital. And I was like, I got a hospital, you know. And I woke up the next morning with puke in my hair and on my softball t-shirt, and it was a mess. And my mom made me go to school, and that was my punishment. After that, I tried to really keep close track of any kind of drinking that I did, because I was an athlete and I didn't like hangovers. That was like the worst day ever, going to school like 7 in the morning with, you know, like that taste in your mouth and like that headache, and I was drinking all this water and then I was throwing up by second period. It was horrible. So, you know, but I knew I was going to do it again. I was just really going to keep a grasp on it so I wouldn't have to go there again. And I was able to do that. And the way that it worked for me is that during softball season, I'd get really good, you know. Like, I wouldn't smoke any weed, and I wouldn't drink any alcohol, and I'd work out really good because I was like, I'm into this, you know, the sports thing. And I keep my grades real good so I could play. And then in off season, I was a jerk, and I was like a drunk, and I was like the one that like, uh-oh, Jen's going to drink too much or whatever, like, watch out. So, you know, I was just kind of crazy teenager, and when I drank like that, like that first session, like blackout, puke in my hair, bath. And then something happened when I was 16, and I remember. My dad went to work on a Saturday, and he was in a room. He was an electrician. And this is my best guy, like the rock of our family, the you know, everything to us, you know, in our family. And he went to work on a Saturday on his day off, and there was an explosion at his work, and he was killed in that accident. And I was at a softball tournament that he was supposed to be at, and they made me go back, you know. And I got there, and that's what happened, you know. And if I couldn't deal with my feelings before, I certainly couldn't deal with that. And I was the oldest, you know. I had a little brother, and my mom lost her soulmate, and I became like, you know, okay, I had to take care of the family. Because I was 16, and that's what I had to do. But I was my self-appointed role. And, you know, I just, I did everything for them that I could do, and then, I escaped as soon as possible because my mom wouldn't have the whole, like, drunk in the house and doing whatever other substances to let me drink for longer. So I had to get out, you know, and by 19 I was, like, going to be out, going to do my own thing. And I remember specifically telling her, like, I want to go out and play. I'm done with this, you know, and that's what I did. I moved out and, you know, I had this buddy who were in college. And his buddy named Renee, and she would always be like, from the first time we met, she was like holding my Letterman jacket off the bridge of the trestles where like the trains, you know, like, don't jump, you know? And she was always saying, like, maintain, just maintain, dude, maintain, just calm down. And that was her role in my life, and along with a lot of my other friends, you know, just trying to keep me alive when I would get drunk and crazy. And so that's kind of how my drinking continued. And it continued that way for a long time, and for a long time it worked for me. Like, I didn't have to feel my feelings. I didn't have to deal with, you know, the bullshit that I didn't want to deal with in life. And alcohol was my best friend. And, you know, and I would get into relationships where someone was a worse drunk than me, so that I'd be like, well, something's wrong with them. It's not my problem, you know. And that's what I did. And And I did some geographics, and I moved around, and I got into this relationship finally where, like, this one was really bad, and I knew, like, we gotta stop drinking because you're crazy when you drink, you know? And so I did that, and that lasted about 6 months until, like, it all went to hell, and, like, I was like, I'm leaving, goodbye, you know, because I could run. And I ran back to Fresno and, like, got the least amount of responsibility possible that I could get, and then I went on my downward spiral where I found, like, the perfect codependent to get in a relationship with who would hold all the shit together while I just spiraled downward. And that lasted a few years. I was when I was about 24. I was just turning 24 and came back to Fresno. And by 27, I was in my first detox, inpatient detox, here in Visalia. And I was at over at Quia Delta for 5 days inpatient. Because by then, my drinking was all day, every day, vodka. If I was awake, I was drinking. And I was miserable. And I destroyed pretty much everything I could get my hands on. I was like a Tasmanian devil, you know, just like destroying things. Like friendships and relationships with my family and just whatever I could. And I was, you know, I was empty. And I was just like the shell of a human being. And I got into a program after detox, and they told me to do all this stuff. And I was like, I'm so done with drinking because I was so miserable, you know. But this is for the newcomer. This specifically is for the newcomer if it's your first time around. My first time around, I did steps 1, 2, 3, and 12. I skipped everything in between. And I took minimal suggestions from my sponsor, and I couldn't shut my fucking mouth and do what I was told. So, needless to say, it's funny that this date is today. What's today? May 9th? May 9th of 2006, when I had 4 days shy of 17 months sober doing my half measures program, I took a drink. It was today. It was 2006 today. And I remember looking at that. I had this huge party. You know, what happened during that 17 months was I forgot to change my behavior like they tell us to do. And I became again, after a year sober, I became a liar and a cheater. And I started messing stuff up. And then I was guilty. And then eventually I had to drink over it. So I had this party at my house with all this alcohol for this girl who was turning 21. I had destroyed, like, my relationship, my home life, everything, you know, that was all gone. And there was all this alcohol left over the next day. And it was May 9th, and there was grapefruit vodka. And I never had grapefruit vodka before. And there was squirt, so it was perfect. And I was like, I'm going to do this. And I got on my knees, and I prayed to God. Because I always believed in a higher power. I just knew he didn't really care about what I was doing, you know. But I got on my knees, and I prayed that God would make me into a normal drinker. Because God can do anything. And then I took that drink, and the control that I had was this much. It was like, and once the alcohol was in my system, I was completely insane again. And I had, you know, at that point I drank, I don't know how many more, and passed out on the sofa like a normal drinker does. So I stayed back out for about a year and a half. About 2 weeks after that, my sponsor found me. You know, I think I called him drunk. And I was like, I'm going to throw myself off the curb, you know. And he came and he's like, you need to go to CAP. And this is like a really high-scale place over in Fresno. the way that it was at Quia Delta was like, there was like really good food in the cafeteria. And there was like an artist, an art therapist, and like a recreational therapist, and like a something else therapist. And like, they'd come get you. If you want to sleep in, you could. And they come get you, and they take you to draw a picture. Then they take you to, like, run on the treadmill. And then you go for a really good lunch over to the cafeteria, and it was, like, really good food, right? Well, when I went to CAP, because my sponsor suggested it, and I was like, I don't know, I had been drinking for about 4 days straight, and I missed work for, like, two, and they're like, you need to go to CAP. And I was like, whatever, I'll do anything, you know, again. And so I went there, and it was, first of all, no Librium for the detox. There was no artist therapist. There was no recreational therapist. I did not have my own room anymore. I was in this little room with about 5 beds in it and a bunk bed with a stinky crackhead next to me. And they took my bra and my clothes and put me in an orange jumpsuit and gave me somebody else's chanclas to wear. And this was a low for me. And I went, I'm never, ever going to do this again, you know. And I got out of there 3 days later, and I was like, I'm going to just wait till I have 30 days so I can go back to a meeting so I have to introduce myself as a newcomer, you know. And I didn't go back after 30 days. I stayed sober for about 40, and then, you know, I was drinking again. And at that point, you know, they talk about a head full of AA and a tummy full of booze. I had to drink so much to forget about what I learned here, you know, that I was always drunk. And during that time, you know, we read at the beginning, the chapter 3, about, you know, switching from beer to wine and, you know, all that stuff. And I did that. I switched from, like, vodka to gin and then to tequila. And then I was like, fuck it, Jägermeister on the rocks, you know. And, horrible. And, you know, none of it worked. And I tried everything to not come back to AA because I was like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go back to AA. And I used to, like, get real drunk, you know. Get really drunk and be like, your hats are off to me in the front yard while I tried to mow the lawn, you know, because I remember that, like, no matter how much I drank, that shit was stuck in my head, and I'm like, your hats are off to me, and your hats are, you know, pointing at whoever was listening, and crashing the lawnmower into everything, going to the hardware store 5 times a day for getting something purposefully so I could go back to the liquor store next to the hardware store, and it was just a mess. And life goes on, and when I got drunk again, the perfect codependent came back to, like, hold the shit together, because when I was sober, she went away, because that's how they do, and life goes on, you know, life goes on, and we got, like, licensed to get, like, foster kids and all this stuff through Fresno County, and I'm, like, this drunk asshole, you know? And they're like, we're going to give you foster kids because you don't have a criminal record and you pass the tests. And so, you know, in 2007, I walk into Fresno Community Hospital and, you know, they hand me this little baby boy and he's 3 days old and I'm looking at him and I know that I have to stop drinking. And before that, I had just succumbed to the fact that I was going to die an alcoholic and that was okay with me. But as I held this little baby, I thought, I have to stop drinking. Because I would like to be the kind of parent that my parents were to me, and I can't do it while I'm drinking. So in that, you know, time, I wanted it again. And the only place I've ever been in my life where I've been able to maintain any kind of sobriety is in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me a little bit. It took me 30 days, and it took me doing some really just shitty things while trying to care for this little baby, you know. And I was a Tasmanian devil, you know, just destroying things, you know. I did things like wait till he was taking a nap and then drive to the liquor store real quick and left him all alone. And that's not okay. And I knew it wasn't okay. And I knew I had to get better. So I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 30 days old. He was 29 days old. It was September 14th, and I was drunk. It was 6:30 a.m., and I was drunk already. And I'm crying at the AA meeting, you know. I'm crying, and I know it's over. And I know that my best friend alcohol has to go away, because no matter how much we love our moms and our brothers and our kids, this disease keeps us delusional. It keeps us sick. All our old ideas keep us right there where we have to keep drinking. It keeps our behavior bad, so we have to feel guilty, so we have to keep drinking. And for me, when I walked back in that morning and surrendered, I knew it was over, and I thought, we go to work today, and when I get out of work, the detox over the weekend, and that's that, you know, and I'm being AA now. I'm surrendering, I'm going to go to AA, I'm going to do whatever they say. Well, by noon at work, I was in, like, a half blackout, and I couldn't handle it, you know. I was, like, crying at my computer and, like, acting a fool, answering the phone drunk, you know. And I walked in my boss's office, and I told him I needed help. And I think that was just part of, like, the total surrender that I had to do to stay here this time, that I had to be accountable to everybody, my family, my work, you know, people in AA. And I got to get back in these rooms, and I got to not lose my job because I went into him and told him that, you know, what was going on. And I got to go to treatment, and I got to get paid while I did it. And, like, just all these, you know, immediately blessings of just trying to get sober. And, you know, for the first time, I walked in the rooms, and I shut up like my psychologist had told me to do the first time around. You know, shut up and do what you're told. And because I was willing. If they had told me to, like, eat dog poop for the first 30 days and you'd stay sober, I'd have done it. I was that desperate. And it talks about it in our big book, Desperate as Only the Dying Can Be. I was there. And they didn't ask me to eat dog poop. And nobody here probably will ask any of you newcomers to do that. If they do, they're messing with you. So the way that worked was I started working the steps. And, you know, in my misery of drinking again and doing all that stuff, I had gotten to a place where I just wanted to die. I wanted to kill myself. And I've never been suicidal. If anything, I get angry and homicidal, you know. And in the end of that, I was. And I can remember searching my house for the key to my gun cabinet. And I guess I had hidden it from myself another time drunk. And when I got sober again, within the first 2 months, I remember being on my knees crying, praying to God for, like, I'll do whatever, and, you know, I'm going to listen to this sponsor lady, I'm going to do what she says. And I remember that third step prayer on my knees the first time, you know, and I remember really meaning it. And it came with tears, because when I really mean stuff and I'm praying, I cry. And the next week, I found the key to that gun cabinet. And I was just grateful that I couldn't find it when I was looking for it. And about 5.5 months sober, my life completely fell apart. Because the perfect codependent doesn't stay when mine didn't stay when I got sober. So I thought that I was going to lose my kid, and I was losing the whole family, the whole dream of the family, you know. And I didn't know what to do. Like, you know, my instinct was, all right, kill everybody and take the boy and run to Mexico. That wouldn't work. So I was like, my second thought was call your sponsor, and I did that. And she didn't answer the phone, but I went to where I knew where to go. I went to the fellowship that I got sober at, and there was guys there setting up a meeting, and I'm like crying and laughing, and like, you know, like how we do when everything's going wrong. And my sponsor found me, and within half an hour, I was surrounded by women in this program that I knew loved me, that were going to help me walk through that stuff. And that's been my experience with anything bad that's happened. And, you know, the loss of a relationship was minimal compared to some of the things that I watched the people in this program walk through and, like, throw themselves in the middle of AA and, like, survive it, and they don't have to drink. And when I got back, you know, a lady said to me, she's like, you know, you never have to do this again if you don't want to. And I didn't believe her, but I was willing to do whatever they told me to do. And the truth has been that I've never had to drink again if I didn't want to. And when the things in this life don't go my way, if I just, it says, what do you read at the beginning? Practical experience shows us that nothing will so ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. That's been my experience as well. You know, when all that stuff happened and it was all going bad and I thought my kid was going to go away, because, you know, I had not been sober very long. So, you know, saying I'm going to tell CPS that you're a drunk loser, it was kind of current. You know, it wasn't that long prior to that, you know. So I just did what I was supposed to do, which was, you know, go to the classes and do what they told me to. Fill out this paperwork by this deadline. Luckily, the other party was busy dating or whatever, so she didn't do the stuff. And I was staying sober, so no one could say, you're a drunk loser right now. You know, I remember that same psychologist looking at me, the one who told me to shut the fuck up, looking at me and telling me, do this, do all this stuff, do not take a drink, because if you take a drink, it's over. They win. You don't get to have the kid, you know, cause, and I know, if I take a drink, I'm not any good to anybody. And, you know, I got to keep that boy and adopt him by myself as a single parent. And when he was 17 months old, his little brother was born. And they called me. And this loser drunk, that used to be the Tasmanian devil, they're like, hey, you want another baby? He's cute. And I was like, yeah, bring him, you know? So that was, you know, it's amazing, the gifts that have been given to me, because I was able to just show up here and start doing what somebody else told me to do. You know, by every rule of this world, I should be dead or in jail. And that's just how it is. And I know that daily when I wake up, and I'm so grateful that I'm not. And that I had the opportunity to, you know, become a parent. Because I wasn't going to do the whole natural childbirth thing. Not my thing, you know. And I really think, you know, they're absolute blessings. And you know, I get to have the one, but they gave me his brother too. And these kids make me laugh every day. I get to be the parent that I wanted to be today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And when all the stuff went bad, you know, I remember being like, you know, I don't know, this isn't any fun, and it's not going to be, you know, because being sober is hard work, if you guys have noticed. It's really hard to have to deal with, like, your feelings and, like, other people and, you know, daily life. And just, you know, brushing your teeth every day sometimes is a chore, you know? And it's all about, you know, maintaining this spiritual connection, and it's a lot of work. But I know when I'm asking, and that's why he was saying, you know, my catchphrase or whatever, are you willing to go to any lengths? Because I ask myself that probably twice a week, you know, because I can get ungrateful too, even though, you know, if I really think about it, I'm just lucky to be alive. But when I do, I go, am I willing to go to any lengths? And the answer today is yes. And the answer from, you know, has been yes. And that's why I've gotten to stay here. You know, it's been a hell of a ride, and I've been very, very blessed. So today, you know, I get to raise two little boys. I get to be a good parent. I get to be a good daughter again to my mother. I get to be a good partner to a good partner. I get to have, like, a healthy relationship where there's, like, adult conversations and not a bunch of chaos and drama. That's cool. I didn't know I could do that. I get to be a good sister, you know. I get to watch the fellowship grow up around me as I sponsor people that are new and, like, see them grow and change. You know, when I got here and things would fall apart, I would call my sponsor, and I'm like one of those ranters, you know, and be like, and this is going on, and blah, 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 and blah, 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 and you don't know, and my sponsor would go, Jen, take a deep breath. Read page blah, 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 write blah, 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 and call me back. And I'd be like, didn't you hear my problem? Obviously, this lady can't hear my problem. You know, I need to kidnap a little boy, kill another dyke, move to Mexico, stop the phone records, you know. But I didn't. I shut up, and I did what she said, and I read whatever, and I wrote whatever, and I got to stay sober. And that, I don't know how it worked, but it worked, you know. And when I would call again like that, and she'd go, you need to speak on the panel at Westcare tonight with us. Obviously, you can't hear my problem, you know. But I would do what she said, and I'd go and I'd speak, and I'd speak to people who walked in Westcare, you know, for 30 or 60 or 90 days, and I got to stay sober. And I didn't know why I was doing it, and I didn't know how it was going to keep me sober, but it did. And I talked about, you know, when I was drinking, and there was, you know, all that fun, and then there was, like, somewhere in there I crossed this line. And then it wasn't fun anymore, and I couldn't stop drinking. And I don't know when it happened. I don't know how it happened. But I know I was there, and I was fucked. Sorry. Excuse my language. And I look at AA, and it kind of mimics my drinking that way. It's like I was going, and I was going to meetings, and I didn't really want to. I didn't want to go speak on Westcare panels when I was having a meltdown. I didn't want to go write whatever and read whatever and, you know, do the stuff the sponsor was telling me to do when I was having a meltdown and I needed to kidnap people and do whatever, you know. But I did. And somewhere, I crossed this line. And today, I want to go. You know, my life's good today. But when someone called me, like Bill called me. I don't know if anybody knows him. but he said, can you come speak in Visalia? And I was like, if I can get the night off work, I'll come speak in Visalia. I want to do these things today because you got to give it away to keep it. And I know that today. And I know that, you know, even though nothing's going bad right now, you know, just out of gratitude for this program and the life that I have today, if I can do this, I'll do it. Every time. You know, and all I can do is do the work to hope that it stays that way. Because the life that Alcoholics Anonymous is giving me today is beyond anything that I would have planned for myself. So, that's my story. Thank you. We have time for questions and answers. I hope I have the answer. Anyone? Bueller? How old are my kids? 4.5 and 3. My sobriety date and my oldest birthday are exactly 30 days apart. Thanks. It was hard, and it was only one to begin with. It kind of grew up around me, you know. And I have an amazing mom who's like super grandma. So she was a good parent. She's an even better grandma. So I have a lot of help.